Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators in the UK and beyond.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured. Today, I'm super pleased to have Arthur Farooq with us. Arthur has had a story journey in and out of venture. She's the co-founder of Muslimic Makers, a meetup and networking group to get Muslim makers involved in tech startups, design and development, together to discuss and share their thinking and work. She's an angel investor at Ada Ventures and is currently working with NHSX to build a community of artificial intelligence practitioners in healthcare. Welcome, Arthur. Really great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Let's jump straight into it. So you've had like what I can only describe as a pretty varied career, and your entry into the world of tech was atypical in itself. How did you end up working with innovative businesses, and what drew you to them in the first place, I guess?
Yeah, sure. So I guess my story really started in my final year of university. I was on a young people's charity program called Spark a Metal. It was to kind of help young people from underrepresented backgrounds break into the industry. I was studying a media degree at the time, and I actually thought that was what I wanted to go into. And, you know, I was being connected to professionals. Obviously, naturally, I didn't have any connections in that field. However, what was really interesting was the program was all delivered online. So this is 2012, you know, way before COVID and the pandemic and everything. So it was designed in quite an innovative way. It was delivered through what was known, well, Google Hangouts at the time, basically. And, you know, we would basically like jump on a call, like a weekly coaching type call with like a person. So my person was Eugenie, who actually was the co-founder of the charity. And she's currently now social impact lead or head at Uber, actually. So that's now what she's currently up to. And yeah, so it was really fascinating because I think at that time, youth unemployment was also at its all-time highest. And we had this amazing innovative program, but to be honest, it could only help like 12 people at a time. So we wanted to think about how we could scale it. At that time, lots of pots of money had opened around how do you solve for youth unemployment. We just applied. We're like, oh, you know, we have this innovative program. Maybe we can create some kind of website or something and try to scale the learnings. Applied for that, got a pot of money, started working with an agency. That launched what was basically then known as Discoverables. And it was basically a website where you have these missions for kind of young people to take to kind of help them build soft skills, let that be positive relationships, spark, resilience, or anything like that. Yeah, so that basically became my baby. That was like a thing that I was just really interested in. I was kind of in and out of employment at that time, mainly unemployed actually, did a, like maybe an internship, started applying for more funding, got funding, and then like basically got told by the CEO of the charity, hey, like you're co-founder of this thing. And I was like, oh, okay, didn't really quite know what that meant, especially legally either. A year on the accelerator, accepted on an accelerator, Wyra Limited. And then, yeah, unfortunately, I also kind of realized that we'd never paid the tax man. And so the money that we had left over, then we basically realized that we didn't pay the tax man. It was just something that I had randomly just picked up one day, and I was a bit like, oh, how does PAYE work? And realized that I was like paying ourselves like through our bank account and not actually accounting for like PAYE stuff. We were very, you know, like I said, I was, you know, somebody out of university. Finance wasn't her strong point. So there was just a lot of things that we were just kind of doing that was just beyond our comfort zone. But still, I had like a great year, a super great year, you know, literally at the peak of the London tech scene, literally starting out. And that's basically what kind of threw me into kind of venture, startups, the tech world, ultimately. But yeah, that basically kind of drew the founder journey, well, the first founder journey to a close.
That's incredible. First of all, you're showing your age, because I think Google Hangouts has rebranded about six times since then. I think it's been canned. I keep getting messages that I need to shift somewhere else, if I'm not mistaken. But effectively, as you say, that was kind of early stages EdTech, when EdTech was still, I guess, in its infancy and trying to find, you know, a place outside of MOOCs and so on, which is wild. I think, you know, just, and again, I couldn't help but obviously draw on the fact that your description of what happened when you realized the tax man was coming is something we get involved in quite regularly as well. Obviously, as CFOs, it's one of the first things we look at. And it's one of the first things that I think tends to be an issue in a lot of early stage businesses, because people, as you say, they don't have the background, they don't have the knowledge. Startups are still businesses. They still have to do, you know, whatever you need to do. But I guess these are massive learnings at the end of the day, and they kind of build resilience for the future. So I think having been through it is probably not as bad a thing at all, not having been through it and then being thrown into it.
Yeah, I'm so much more like vigilant now of these kind of things. You know, I know we'll go into the Summit Makers later, but just when I set it up recently, like the first thing I was like, right, I need to get myself an accountant, or like just have somebody that I can just call upon on with these things.
Yeah, I think it's super necessary, and like it's an investment that's worth making. But before we get to Islamic Makers, you are a 2017 Winston Churchill Fellow, and you spent a lot of time researching Muslim women in tech in the USA, in the UAE and Pakistan. So talk us through why this was such an important area to focus on, and what did your research find? And I guess, how did that then lead on to what you're doing now?
Yeah, sure. So I guess that was really an interesting journey. So Islamic Makers was founded in 2016. And when I was doing Islamic Makers, I realized, you know, from one angle, I was basically trying to be like super inclusive, you know, about Muslim representation. But actually within that, I was mainly attracting a lot of Muslim men. And it started to make me question actually where the Muslim women are within the tech field. But when I would like type Muslim women in tech in Google, I would come across these amazing stories of like Muslim women in America with startups or working in like, you know, big companies like Google, Facebook, etc. Likewise in Pakistan, and actually where a lot of Muslim women are studying engineering degrees, and likewise in the Middle East. So I was really fascinated by actually, I think especially I would say in Pakistan and the Middle East, where, you know, the Western world might turn their nose down on those countries, but actually they were far exceeding in STEM fields. And it just kind of got me really fascinated in it. So I guess, yeah, I was just at a point in my life where I just wanted something different. Applied for that fellowship opportunity, kind of got it, and just had the most incredible experience. I kind of vlogged my travels and made like video YouTube interviews with Muslim women, because I just felt like that was the best way for me to kind of represent my research. And I guess ultimately, I mean, my research kind of really, it drew out a lot of themes. And actually, like one of them I would say was, often actually it was an accident for these women. You know, they all kind of fell into tech, and which actually when I talk about my own story was actually quite common, that often especially in the Western world anyways, it was a, you know, an accident. They just happened to be kind of in somewhere or introduced to someone or etc. Then obviously, you know, in Pakistan and like the Middle East, it was interesting because they would study STEM fields, but then some of them may go into starting their own startups, but then some of them actually wouldn't. And Pakistan government actually recognized that and actually said, okay, how do we then empower these women to tap into the Fiverr and Upwork economy, right? How do we enable them to work from home? You know, how do we enable it? And there was this one startup as well, where it was at that time known as Doctors, but they recently rebranded, and they recognized this specific problem around women doctors, how women doctors in Pakistan would get like trained up in the subjects, but after marriage, they wouldn't practice as much. So what this lady basically did was just create this whole startup where in villages, she would set up like remote virtual points. And then these women who are kind of working from home would be able to kind of like dial in and, you know, support the women and stuff. So there was just a lot of really interesting, I guess, kind of findings and startups. And I think, again, like, especially if we talk about the Pakistan tech economy, 2017, again, super early, you know, there wasn't that much venture backing for Pakistan tech startups then, compared to obviously now, when, you know, there's a lot of money actually being invested in that country, where people are starting to see actually there's a lot of young talent. And then also, I think there were other themes as well that I kind of saw, like, you know, how a lot of these women had supportive partners, you know, that was like a real kind of theme that I came across. and also just kind of how they kind of navigated dialogue with kind of, you know, parents about entering these industries and stuff. So I was able to kind of, I guess, pick out these themes really and kind of take those findings back and learning, but also, you know, just seeing how organizations and initiatives were being run there kind of gave me a lot of inspiration for like Mazamet Makers as well, and how I want to develop and take Mazamet Makers forward as well.
That's super interesting, because obviously we live in a country where there are a huge number of tropes around female empowerment when it comes to Muslim women especially. So everything you just said there is diametrically opposite to, I think, a lot of, you know, certainly the kind of broadsheet media representation, right? So at the end of the day, or the tabloid representation maybe. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, what you described there is Muslim women, you know, working in STEM, studying STEM, going out, doctors, engineers, the government assisting and empowering their ability to enter kind of the fields that they're, you know, that they're interested in, their partners supporting them. I think that's a super important thing. I think, you know, certainly in the West, we have such a, I think, poor visualization of what happens in other countries. It's not obviously just Muslim countries, but whether it's Africa, whether it's the Indian subcontinent, whether it's Southeast Asia in general or LATAM, I think we have these very sort of very rigid or narrow mental models that don't tend to actually bear out, you know, the reality bears out something quite different. So that's actually quite an interesting sort of segue into Mazamet Makers. So I guess, why did you build the community? What was your kind of purpose behind that? And why is it important to you?
Yeah, sure. So I think with Mazamet Makers, again, starting up back in 2016, me and my co-founder, Murtaza, who, you know, we found each other through the best platforms possible, Twitter. He kind of approached me saying, hey, I've got this idea. You work in tech, I work in tech. We're both Muslim. I think there's other people like us. And we got together. And at that time, I was working at Makers Academy, the coding bootcamp. And there, what was really interesting was, we were doing a lot of stuff, diversity initiatives, again, around women. But I was always really fascinated, again, about kind of ethnic minorities, religious minorities, that kind of stuff. Makers was very kind to lend us their space. And I had literally met like a Muslim entrepreneur, I think, like the weekend before. And I'm like, right, I have a speaker. I have an event space. Let's just put these people, you know, let's just put people in a room together and see what happens. And like, we had like 50 or so people like turn up to our first event, and then a lot of people, you know, some working in tech already and some just interested in the industry. And that basically like formed the basis of the community. And I think in our early days, it was all about consistency. You know, the fact that we were super consistent, every 6 weeks we were putting on some kind of event. And I think a lot of the London tech scene started to pay attention to us at that time, inviting us to use their space, sponsoring our food. So we just ended up like curating this community. And in our early days, I would say it was very focused on Muslim role models. But then a couple of years down the line, we actually realized, you know, allyship and stuff was really important. And actually often that's where the power lies. And actually to kind of, we want to build that bridge between our community and like the powerful people, basically. So we kind of started to have more of a kind of mixed panels approach, etc. as well. So that was kind of, I would say, kind of the early basis was a very events-based community, and the Slack thing was just like there in the background, and social media was just there to serve a purpose, just to promote an event. We never really focused much on the online community. Didn't ever need to. Literally, I'd put on a, you know, we'd put together an event, send a newsletter, and it'd be sold out. So there was never like an effort or a conscious effort of having to kind of promote like so much. But then obviously when COVID hit, that obviously took Mazamet Makers through a bit of an identity crisis. You know, events was always our magic source, and like what was next. And I always had an itch for developing programs, having gone through programs myself that ultimately kind of impacted my life. So we developed a program at that time that was called the Kickstarter. Before the government announced their scheme called the Kickstarter, we have that a lot. We like mention a name, and then like 5 weeks later, the government always seems to like call something similar to something we've called.
Rishi must have been listening very hard.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah, exactly. And that was basically one of our first programs that we actually delivered for, I think it was about over 30 or so people, where it was specifically, I recognized with my work with the community that often, like the tech industry is very daunting because there's just so many different career paths. And actually, if we put on these practical workshops and like, you know, put people in touch with mentors, etc., then they'll be able to kind of start learning more about those fields and just have more of a, easier starting point rather than being like, I want to go into tech, but I don't know what. So that led to some really good outcomes of like, again, jobs wasn't the outcomes for that program. It was more education. But actually, we had people, you know, go into analytics programs. Somebody became a user researcher off the back of it. Because again, as part of that program, we had a startup task where they had to work with one of the startups from our community to do a user research exercise. So there was little elements like that, you know, just to kind of give a bit of experience. That was all again delivered online. And that's, I think, is when I kind of realized that actually Mosaic Makers, obviously the community is kind of everything, but actually we're now going down, I would say, more of an upskilling a route. And actually we want to upskill and level up the community ultimately. And again, that's like another thing, another word that we started to use and then the government starts to use it. Yeah. So that, I think, like now, so last year anyways, I was like, right, 5 years of Mosaic Makers, what's next, right? We've had COVID, obviously naturally that led to our virtual community becoming more global. How do we also serve that global audience? So there was a lot of questions. I also had to rebuild my whole voluntary team again, because again, with communities, people come and go, you know, people come and go, people grow. Like literally, I think about actually some of our early members and like where they are currently in their personal life is extremely completely different to obviously when, you know, they first kind of started out. And likewise, the new members joining who, you know, are fresh university graduates, they were in school when we started. Like, it's really weird to kind of think that actually. And so now it's like, okay, but to attract that newer generation, we've got to be a bit more active on our social media. We've got to build up our brand a bit more kind of, you know, online, etc. So there's a lot more, I would say, slightly different kind of challenges that have come our way. But yeah, last year was actually the first time I actually officially registered Mosaic Makers, because I never needed it to actually be a legal entity before that. You know, people trusted me. They were like, yeah, here you go. Here's some money, you know. And of course, I would track it on a spreadsheet, but there was no kind of need for a separate bank account or anything like that. Anywho, applied for a few grants, you know, was quite successful in getting them, and then literally gone from like never having money to having money now and being like, oh, I have to scale this organization while also obviously doing this on top of a day job. I thought money would solve our issue, but it never does. And actually, it's all about kind of resource and finding the right talent and finding the right model that works for us as well. So I think that's kind of where we are now with our journey. We've just run a successful tech scholarship program, where again, another Muslim organization called Aziz Foundation, which normally traditionally actually funds masters and Muslim people to do masters, actually we convinced them to actually give us some money to fund alternative tech courses. And we partnered up with Makers and Love Circular to do that. So to get Muslim people coding and kind of to UX UI design. So we're just in the kind of interview phase of kind of selecting our six scholars for that, which is super exciting, because that was always the missing piece of MM. It's like we had the events in the community, which was the entry level of the pyramid. Then we started to do our own internal stuff around mentoring and, you know, workshops. But that hard skills bit was always missing. And I'm a true believer that you don't have to do everything. Like, we don't have to be the people that also deliver the hard skills, because we know there are great organizations that do that already. But actually, what we need is the funds to send those people to those organizations. So it's like, almost feel like actually now we've got that full circle as well, where we take people from one entry point completely to the other. So that's kind of where we are currently. A lot to figure out, if I'm honest with you, especially leading it, you know, now being like official CEO of it and not just co-founder. It's like a lot to kind of think about in terms of funding, keeping my grant people happy, you know, delivering the projects, but actually most importantly, self-sustainability. You know, yes, I've been given some money that's bought me a year to kind of fund these projects, but now how do I create these projects in such a way, either through brand sponsorship, etc., where actually I'll always bring in money to then kind of fund the next set of projects for the year after. So that's kind of where I currently am.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with a couple of sort of community-based, events-based businesses. And it's really interesting to me because I think they start off being events-based businesses that then quickly morph into mentorship, learning, education. I think obviously the move to online versus offline has driven that even further. In fact, I remember pitching a couple of years ago to turn an events-based business into basically an edtech platform with mentoring and I guess membership that builds a community that was valuable for everyone rather than just a few people. I think where you've gotten to is exactly that kind of pinnacle point where it's like, now how do we sustain that beyond, to your point, sort of loose donations or irregular donations, and how do we turn that into a self-sustaining or repeatable model that we can bring people into and through? And interestingly, I recently brought on a UX designer who unfortunately left us after a short period of time, but I think she went through the Love Circular program, and I've got a feeling she was also fairly affiliated with Islamic Makers, so I can definitely attest to the fact that whatever you're doing is working. And I certainly hope that you are able to find a way of making that a perpetual and sustaining thing, such that it's A, not reliant on you, but also, you know, builds a community that, as you say, you know, if you've got kids going in there from school through to university, that's huge testament to the sticking power and the value of it, because, you know, 5-6 years in a community is, you know, it's a pretty decent amount of time to be spending.
Just quickly add to that, I guess, I think, again, I would say like another challenge with especially community stuff, especially if you're serving an underprivileged community, is for me, I don't want to charge the community or charge like a membership fee. We've sometimes charged for events to just cover our costs, like a fiver, but hey, it's free if you're a student, etc. But for me, the money's not going to come from the community. So it's a real kind of, some of our community members actually do donate to us as well. But again, it took me a very long while to even be okay with that and set up a Stripe, because I was a bit like, well, you know, some of my mentors had to sit me down and be like, look, there's people in your community that are privileged and do want to give. So don't be like, oh no, no, like, you know. And I think it's the psychology of even just trying to get over myself a bit and just being like, no, actually fine. Like, if there's some people that want to give us money, like, it's okay to take money from them, you know. But that's never been like my heavy push angle. So for me, I think it will definitely come from more of a B2B brand sponsorship, that kind of model. But obviously that model is so much more, I would say, harder and longer sales cycles and etc. But I'm excited, you know, I think that's when things get really interesting. So yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a very hard thing for a founder to be vulnerable. And, you know, it feels like you're asking for help rather than being given, not even help, you're being given support because someone believes in what you're doing. And I think that's a very positive thing. I think I'd agree with you. The B2B cycle, A, you've got to find people that are passionate about what you're doing, that buy into the cause and buy into what you're building. And to your point, develop those relationships and show and build trust. But I have no doubt you'll be able to do it, just having had a look at kind of what else you're up to. So kind of moving on from Islamic Makers, you've spent a huge amount of time working in government. And whilst your most recent work is at NHSX, you've also spent time as the Innovation Fellowship Program Lead for Number 10. So I'd love to understand what the ambitions of that program were and what the outcomes actually were.
Yeah, sure. So the Number 10 Innovation Fellowship Program, I was recruited into the role pretty much this time last year, actually. It was one of those programs that was inspired by the White House Presidential Fellowship Scheme, which has been running in America for about 7 years. It was started under the Obama administration. And ultimately, it's about attracting private talent that tends to work in the tech field and bringing them into senior roles actually in government to help kind of innovate around specific problems. So when I was kind of recruited into that role, it wasn't designed, right? It was a program that was not designed at all. I kind of really had to think about actually the process of designing that program, working in collaboration with different departments as well, which also can be quite a challenge in government. You know, we then basically had different government departments put forward specific problems. Like, I think there was one problem from Department for Education, which was around like the future of education post COVID-19, all sorts of really interesting problems. And then we designed a recruitment process around those problems so that when somebody was applying, it might have been like, okay, DfE is looking for a product manager and a data scientist, senior people, but around that problem. that obviously led to a really, really interesting people applying. And even when I was designing the recruitment process, I wanted it to be less governmenty because I wanted to attract people that just would not normally think about being in government. And I often actually like cite it to myself as well that I accidentally ended up in government. It was, you know, my first role in government was building communities for product managers and delivery managers in government. Only later on, I realized that made me a civil servant, which now meant that I can't be political on Twitter. But it was one of those things where I was attracted to GDS, Government Digital Services, as a department, because they do amazing work with gov.uk. But also the role was what really interested me. So likewise with the fellowship program, it was the roles that I wanted to make super exciting. Recruitment process, I had the option for them to do video rather than a cover letter. You know, I reached out again to all the communities I'm part of, especially communities that kind of had minority talent. And I was really proud actually of the pipeline that I was able to kind of build in terms of kind of, you know, a very diverse pipeline that applied, which ultimately actually did really lead to a diverse cohort. So I think in the end, we recruited probably, I think it's 7 people, I believe, for 7 different departments. And I left though, so I recruited them, I think by the point I recruited them, it was April, May, and then they had to go through all these kind of like ID checks and all sorts of stuff. At that point in time, the opportunity to work at NHSX came up. So I kind of then shifted to that. But it was a real interesting couple of months because it took me to working very close to kind of number 10. I was still based on the GDS side, but working with colleagues at number 10 really got me to into the heart of government. And I guess really the outcomes of it really is they want to, at SCS level, which is like senior civil servant level, they don't have much talent, I would say, or technical talent that comes from the right industry. So often what tends to happen is those people right at the top tend to be quite generalist. And actually what, you know, at the end of the day, to lead massive digital transformation, etc., the people that you want at the top are the people that have already done it before, who are the doers, who may have built startups, you know, or worked in big companies or whatever it is. So ultimately, it was about trying to diversify that, but also because it was just like a 1-year placement, it gives these people a chance to get a taste of government. And then if they want to stay on, they can obviously kind of apply for roles in government. And again, with the presidential USA scheme, I think they managed to basically retain at least 50% of their talent or something into government. So it's quite high. Obviously, they have 7 years ahead of us. But I think that's basically what a lot of the aims and ambitions came from. But also to kind of create culture change, you know. When you take people that come from such different backgrounds, different professional experience, and then put them in organisations that might be a bit old school, you know, they're able to kind of challenge things in a slightly different way. So I think there was just a whole, you know, lots of different things that kind of will lead to interesting things. They've opened up registrations to apply now for the next cohort on their websites. If you just Google it, number 10 Innovation Fellowship Scheme, people can register on the website as well.
I mean, as you were describing that, the first thing that came into my head was the famous Weirdos and Misfits advert. I mean, like, it sounds exactly like what that was driving towards. Not that I presume these were weirdos and misfits, but I think we all understand the kind of general thrust of that. And I think there is, again, that very clear realization that the way that government has been formed and the civil service has been formed over the course of the last several hundred years has ensured that we have a certain type of, I guess, education background or, you know, background in general, I guess, coming into the civil service and actually shaking things up, as you and I both know, right? When you're working, especially in startups, getting that different perspective, getting that specialist skill set, getting that slightly different angle can actually unlock massive potential because you can see things that others maybe have missed up until then. And presumably, like, so now that you've been loaned to NHSX, and you're building this community of AI practitioners within healthcare, presumably you're seeing the same thing. So what are the unique challenges in dealing with such a like hugely transformational topic or potentially transformational topic in an organization that is just drastically slow to change? Like, surely that's a massive challenge.
So that's been really, really, again, really interesting over the last 6 months, where, again, going into kind of NHSX and first and foremost, actually understanding how these organizations work and how actually each trust is its own entity, has its own process. So my hospital trust is different from your hospital trust. Then you have NHS England, which is the national organisation. You have NHSX, which I sit in, which is half NHS England and half Department of Health. And you've got NHS Digital. So, but they all kind of like work under this kind of umbrella. And obviously, so it's really interesting when people use the word like save the NHS, like there isn't a NHS, right? Everybody has their own funds and obviously, et cetera. It's so that first and foremost was actually one of the most interesting things to kind of learn about the healthcare system here and how it's been built up, et cetera. Now, going in from a kind of an AI angle and, you know, artificial intelligence in healthcare is a very interesting topic. And some people are super excited about it. And then you've got other people, some doctors just being like, I just want a laptop that works, right? And it's almost like we can't even think about AI because our basic IT is just not good enough, you know? And so the team that I specifically sit in is called the AI Labs Program. And within that is a really, really cool team called the Skunkworks team. And what the Skunkworks team basically do is an open call. They invite trusts to basically come and pitch ideas to us in terms of things they want to experiment with in terms of AI. And then the team, through kind of a procurement system, is able to find a partner to help them deliver a proof of concept over 12 weeks. Now, the thing to really iterate over those 12 weeks specifically is it's an experiment, right? It's just to prove that this thing could work. So a really good example is a project that the team did with Gloucestershire Hospital called Length of Stay. And basically the whole idea was when people get admitted to hospital, especially like super older folk over like, say, 70 or so, if they stay longer in hospital, their health deterioration actually goes lower because by being in the hospital longer, their muscles, all sorts of stuff, they don't get walking as much, etc. So actually, how could we create a system score where, for example, if somebody comes into hospital on the dashboard, you can see that they're at risk of like staying longer in the hospital, which then means you can intervene quicker. So the nurses, all the people that are looking after them could intervene quicker and actually get them moving and hopefully reduce that length of stay that they have in the hospital. So they were able to kind of, you know, use all sorts of different kind of data points, etc., to kind of build a basically a model. And that model, again, you can read this all up on the website. We have a case study, but also the team actually opens up the GitHub. So it's completely open source because again, if each trust is different, but they all have the same problem. So great. We worked with one trust on a specific problem that probably can apply to all these trusts all across the UK. Now we've had another trust approach us, take the code, the data science from that trust, take the code and start to apply it to their model. So it's been really interesting because actually that's where the community element often actually comes in because it's like, great, we've done one thing. How do we then kind of repeat it? And actually the outcomes end up being we end up saving money, but we're also educating people through AI through these projects because they're able to start seeing actually what's possible. You know, AI, obviously clinical is obviously one angle, but sometimes like operational, you know, another project the team's working on is like managing bed management. So that's more of an operational thing.
Or even how to staff, presumably like staffing levels and like exactly. How do you actually deal with peak times and off times and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember in my early days, actually, I spoke to a doctor who during the whole COVID-19 pandemic got really interested in data science and modeling and stuff. That ended up being his role, like, because obviously the government was you know demanding all this data and stuff. He ended up upskilling and now he's like part data scientist, part doctor, which is like super cool. So, and then I guess kind of, yeah, like I said, my role really is kind of, you know, often there's these projects, like how do I promote them? How do I get them into the community? How do I get people talking to each other as well? Because yes, there's stuff that we are doing centrally, but then there are stuff that the trusts are doing themselves in the AI space. But again, how do I make sure I can create that visibility so that another trust knows that, oh, this trust is also doing that similar thing. Let me just get support from them rather than invest the same amount of time to get the same outcome. So it's been hard, if I'm really honest with you, like to actually kind of navigate that because I think, again, a lot of my community work, you know, there was a certain ways of working and I feel like you know, healthcare is just a different, completely different ballgame. Clinicians are like super busy. But yeah, it's been really interesting. I kind of went in, did a whole discovery research phase. They've got like an online virtual hub, which kind of people can join, which has interesting content about stuff we're doing, a forum. Then, you know, doing an activity phase of doing lots of kind of virtual events, but also I managed to do like an in-person event as well to kind of get the community meeting with each other. And now I'm in kind of my write-up phase, and we developed actually a series of workshops called an AI deep dive that actually, if some people don't quite understand how to kickstart their AI experiment, how do we do that? So I work with the data scientists on my team to design these 5 practical workshops that we can deliver trust by trust. And then actually, again, people can be upskilled through it. So I think often when it comes to community, often it's about capability building as well.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And to your point, you're drawing from your experience building those communities at Muslimic Makers. It's how do you empower and engage, and how do you actually give people the tools and the skills to then go off and make the difference, right? It's like, how do you give them what they need to be able to do the job in front of them, which I think is important in every sort of every industry. But I wanted to kind of move on to your experience as an angel investor. So another thing that you do, of the many things that you do, is that you invest with Ada Ventures. So it'd be great to understand what sort of businesses and what sort of ventures you're long on, like what do you see future in, and why was it important for you to be involved in investing?
Sure. So the investment journey really kind of started off with when I met Chek, one of the partners from Ada Ventures, before it was Ada Ventures, really. Like she was looking to build the fund, and she was very good at actually starting to build a network of scouts that kind of work in these communities so that actually we can bring them deals that for them to potentially kind of invest in. But they also recognized that wasn't enough, and actually instead we needed to put money in the hands of these community operators, these people that already, and actually just back them to back the people that they think are right. So they ran their first angel program basically off the back of that. It was open to the scouts only, and they selected 5 of us angels, and that again has been a massive learning curve for me. As I always say, finance is never my forte. So it's really kind of forced me to really think about, you know, when I'm looking at a startup's numbers or projections or something like that, it's really kind of forced me to think about the story, thinking about how they want to grow, seeing what's possible. I think the interest area for me has been a variety of different things. You know, health tech obviously is one of them, ed tech naturally, community-based type products, things around infrastructure as well, D&I, those kind of areas, or even like anything serving the Muslim economy, for example. Those have naturally kind of been interest areas for me. And I think, you know, when you put like angel investor on your LinkedIn, it's like, oh, you just get like inundated with stuff. And in the beginning, I was like very, again, being the community builder I am, I just felt like I had to reply to everybody. Every email I got, every LinkedIn message, every Twitter, like whatever it was, right? Realized it wasn't self-sustainable, again, doing this on top of all the many projects I have, that actually I needed to create a process, and actually I'll just reply to who really sticks out to me. And I feel really bad doing that, because at the end of the day, you know, like I know people are taking up the time. It also depends how people approach you as well, because sometimes I tweeted about it the other day, but like I got like a LinkedIn message about somebody, it was an alcohol business, and I'm like, you have done no research on me, because if you did research on me, you would see that I speak about this stuff, about it not being inclusive, etc. So sometimes you just get these random, like, cold approaches that make no sense at all. So yeah, so far I've invested in 4 startups. I'm happy to actually share who they are. Yeah, so I've invested in 4 startups. First one being kind of InChorus, which it basically provides analytics and data-led interventions to build more inclusive workplace. So microaggressions, how can an organization actually track that stuff? You know, so it's not this end of year survey where somebody says, oh, I was harassed, this and that. But actually through a Slack bot and like a tool, etc., they've built, they're able to amass this data. And through that data, they're then able to curate content to actually educate those workplaces really, really like the founders. I think that's definitely one thing that you always look at, especially when you're backing startups, is who the founders are and are they the right people to solve the problem. And, you know, the two founders, Raj and Rosie, really interesting backgrounds, had done a lot of work in kind of diversity and inclusion. They definitely, for me, were like winners, already actually had a revenue generating product. So it was, for my first investment, it was like, okay, this makes a lot of sense. Then I think I started to get a bit more, I would say, riskier, more earlier stage. You know, one of the other investments, and that they just appeared in TechCrunch recently, was Framework. And Framework was backed by Founders Forum. And again, it's an edtech product, but specifically, I would say L&D focused around kind of startup operators. And they've basically developed an educational model, which came out of a school that they did. Like, it was like a virtual school, and now they've productized it. Both founders, one of them's called Ria, who I met when I was working at Makers. So when I saw she was behind it, and Asha, who I happened to come across on the Zamit Makers community, I was like, oh my God, two amazing women of color, like working on such an interesting area. Again, you know, I was just like totally like sold by them as founders. Then obviously, naturally, when I started to understand a bit more about the problem they're trying to solve for, that also for me was like really, really interesting. And then there was, these are like not in any order actually, but another Maker's founder, funny enough. So a friend of mine called Chuka, he built a product called Kana. Again, this is more of an infrastructure startup. So this one was a really interesting one because I wouldn't say like infrastructure was like my, you know, go-to like area. But again, I know him really well from my days of when I was working at Makers. He was one of the students there as well. When I saw on Twitter, again, he was building a product. He like also won the debut sessions obsession. I was a bit like, hold on a second, I know this guy. Got in touch with him. We obviously caught up. And then he started to explain to me, okay, pricing tends to be an issue in SaaS products. And actually that often creates a lot of technical debt. So when people are creating different price points for kind of different levels of tier, it's not an easy way to kind of code the system. And ultimately he's creating that infrastructure to make it super easy for people to kind of think of it like the Stripe. I mean, I'm not doing probably justice to the best way to describe it. Again, when I got my head around it, it blew my mind because his product grows every time another startup grows. So again, I was like, and this, like I said, he was like super early, like literally built a very basic MVP, you know, not even at the revenue stage, etc. But him as a founder, super believed in. And my last one is called Noor, which is actually a B2C product. It's specifically focused on meditation and well-being in the Arab region. So think kind of Calm and Headspace, but for that region in the Arabic language. And that dialect. So mental health, etc. awareness is now picking up in those regions. And again, her kind of USB was, you know, you can't just say, oh, it's all in the Arabic language, it's the different dialects. And actually, if you have dialects in, you know, that are speaking to you when you're listening to this stuff. So, and these ones are like all like super pre-seed. And like I was talking to an investor friend of mine, he goes, oh, you're a real investor. Oh, just a bit like, yeah. I was like, yeah, maybe my next ones, I need to be a bit more, maybe a bit more thingy, but I believe in them as founders. And I'm generally very excited about being on that journey with them. Cause literally I was reflecting on it the other day and I'm just like, wow, like all of them are going on their own journeys, some more ahead of others. But it's fascinating because I get to be part of that, you know, I get to be part of that and I get to kind of, and for me, being a value add an angel investor was like super important because look, you know, I only had a small amount of money. I don't have disposable income. I like to think, oh, I'd like to carry on angel investing. But the truth is we just bought a house and all sorts. So I'm not going to have extra money beyond this angel program. So for me, selecting the startups that I could really go on that journey on, because not all of them are going to, you know, I hope they do, but naturally, you know, startups do fail. But if I still gain like learning and education by being on that journey with them, it's like totally worth it.
Yeah.
They're back winners, but again, you know how these things go.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think as you say, angels tend to come in at pre-seed because it's about the founder. It's about the product. It's about, you know, the possibility. VCs tend to come in slightly later stage, certainly here in the UK and elsewhere, because it's more about the financial returns and the concrete financial returns, I guess, right, that one hopes to make, albeit that it's just as risky, I guess, or it gets, you know, it obviously de-risks slightly as you go further along the journey. But Arthur, you've taken us through like just an incredible journey from like uni all the way through to today, and I understand you're soon to begin another journey and going to be a mother very soon, so congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm sure you will teach and learn a lot from your child.
FYI on that, this is going to be published like later, right?
Yeah, it'll be way later. Don't
worry. Okay, that's fine. Yeah, it's one of those things. Like I said, it's not quite something I'm public about. Yeah, if it gets published afterwards, it's all good.
no problem. We can always make sure it's done in a couple of months' time. But yeah, look, it's been absolutely incredible having you here. Thank you so much for sharing your time, your journey. I think it's massively inspirational. Where can people find you? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where's the best place for our listeners to look out for you?
Yeah, so I would say the best place to engage with me is definitely Twitter. So my handle is arf_22. I mean, people can totally connect with me on LinkedIn, but I do have lots of like requests that are outstanding. But honestly, I think the best way to kind of build a relationship with me and engage with me is definitely through Twitter, because there's always a lot of random tweets and things that I tend to tweet on there.
Amazing. Thank you, Arthur. Really, really appreciate your time and have a great day ahead.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts on our conversations, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop me a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?